exterminator minutes to go, soft machine, ticket that exploded, and more recently, a huge novel to be published this fall, this January?
January or February.
I forgot Nova Express.
Yes.
Cities of the Red Night, as well as a forthcoming volume of letters to Allen Ginsberg. It will be published from 1953 to 1956, published already in Switzerland and to be published in New York by Full Court Press. Mr. Burroughs will have conversation or talk or whatever. He's set up on a platform, unfortunately, and probably should have been better down below, but you can see him better. The idea, previous years, Mr. Burroughs has discoursed formally on a subject several days running. This time, we went back to the original idea conceived when the Kerouac School was first opened, which was growing out of Jack Kerouac's idea that Burroughs was one of the most intelligent men in America, that his conversation was real interesting. So Burroughs said he didn't want to make any particular heavy work out of it, so I said, why don't we just do conversation? And I would just sit and talk. So this situation is open, then, for you to talk back or to ask questions or to make comments, preferably not long speeches, but comments or questions, and to draw him out on his opinions, which are generally interesting, sometimes funny, sometimes deplorable, always educational. He has a few ideas we ran over last night of things he's been thinking about cumulatively over the last few centuries. So I'll turn the microphone over to William Burroughs, and then what I would really encourage you to speak up. We have a microphone in the audience which Charlie Ross will be handling, so you'll have a chance to ask questions or to draw out a point. Don't leave any points in your mind unquestioned. In other words, if you got some further curiosity, inquisitiveness, do it. It's a good opportunity to talk back and forth. Ideally, informally. The situation is formal, but our minds are informal, so we can go ahead. Mr. Burroughs.
Good evening. Good evening. Well, I'll start with a few remarks about the nuclear situation. It is to be remembered that on the occasion of the first atomic explosion at Alamogordo, New Mexico, Robert Oppenheimer, the creator and founding father himself, entertained the possibility of a chain reaction that would ignite the atmosphere. And he had to be calmed down by the FBI. They put him away for a couple of days. And 20 years later, in 1965, on a television program, there's a television program about the atomic bomb, and everybody appeared that it had anything to do with it. He said, we are become Shiva, destroyer of worlds. So more than 20 years later, he still thought that the atom bomb would eventually destroy the Earth or render it uninhabitable. And he wiped a tear out of the corner of his eye. And various highly placed military officials appeared to say it was a very difficult decision. They're talking about the decision to drop the atom bomb on Hiroshima. But apparently, by the time they'd done that, it was quite easy to drop another one 2 days later on Nagasaki. And I thought, God defend us all from a difficult decision in the Pentagon. Nobody does more harm than people who feel bad about doing it. Now, the present-day apologists for nuclear power are leaning very far in the other direction. That they say that these plants have a splendid safety record and there's been not a single death or serious injury, which incidentally is not true. And you'll notice that all the old backers of the Vietnam War are now in the pro-nuclear ranks. William Buckley Jr., many others. Not a single death or serious injury. Of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki don't count. Nuclear power, we are told, is safe, and it is a patriotic duty to support it. They somehow created that idea that it is patriotic to support nuclear power. Just why, I don't know. They don't want to hear about chain reactions or cumulative damage to the human genetic pool or the very clear correlation between low-level radiation and cancer. And they, of course, accuse their opponents of being unrealistic. And to one of Buckley's phrases is infected with latent ideological bias. He is really a master of the meaningless sentence. However, of course, Oppenheimer's calculations at Alamogordo, does anyone know the literal translation of that? I know that Gordo is fat. What does Alma mean? Does anyone know? It's not Alma. Alma is soul. But Alma, I don't know. Doesn't anyone know here? Good heavens. Huh? Alamo. Well, it's the same as the Alamo, yeah. But I don't know quite what it means. I know what Gordo means, fat. So it's fat something.
Is there a purpose to the talk?
Hmm?
Is there a purpose to the
talk?
If you
want
to
talk,
where do you think you might?
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
I was just curious to know what the meaning, the actual literal meaning of the Spanish word was, where the first...
Is there a purpose to the whole talk?
There are a number of purposes.
Could you summarize so I could follow better when I, as you're talking? Or would that be too hard?
I couldn't hear you. What'd you say?
Could you summarize the purposes so I could follow the argument better as you talk?
Well, no, I can't summarize and talk at the same time. Well, anyway, Oppenheimer's calculations may have involved simply a quantitative error, and given a sufficient concentration of nuclear fission, such as could occur in a major nuclear accident or a major nuclear war, and Operation Shiva will be in a go condition. Sput. Well, we sounded a word of warning. Yeah.
Ellsberg was here last year, mm-hmm. and we got into a conversation about the Cold War, Russia versus America, and I put him the question that was generally asked, say, by Norman Podhoretz and the Committee on Present Danger, and the conservative politicians: how can we disarm unilaterally and get rid of all the nuclear weapons when the Russians are armed with nuclear weapons and they won't disarm unilaterally? So what is there to do? And I was, what good is a word of warning when we're stuck in a battle with Russia, and Russia's supposed to be so bad, and they would attack, say, Europe or take over? So what? How do you figure a way out of that one?
I don't have a clue, really, as to how any disarmament scheme would really work. Given the amount of bad faith that's implicit in the situation to begin with, if anyone has any ideas on this, I'd be very glad to hear them.
The one idea that Ellsberg had was that since it would be impossible to disarm unilaterally, that the only possible way was a slow, step-by-step, inch-by-inch disarmament, and that's, so he thought the SALT treaty, for all of its flaws, was a step in the right direction, because it was an agreement not to have a war, but to slowly de-escalate the hysteria and de-escalate the physical.
Yes, and do exactly what with the bombs already in existence?
Let them. His idea was just let them die. They do die in time.
How long does it take?
They go out of function after 10 years or so. That's what.
Oh, really? I thought it was much longer than that.
No, the plutonium lasts, but the actual functioning explosive bomb gets obsolete after about 10 years and has to be reprocessed here at Rocky Flats, actually. Yeah. Or the components have to be reprocessed. Yes. Then the old bombs that are sort of obsolete are stored in outside of Santa Fe in a hollow mountain. There are a number of old bombs that aren't usable right now. In other words, the bombs do get obsolete. So he was saying just let them do nothing and let everything go through normal obsolescence. Yeah. That was his idea.
Mr. Burroughs, why not instant disarmament?
Hmm?
Why not instant disarmament?
Well, I have nothing against it. I just don't think that it's very practical. It never has worked.
But neither has war.
Hmm?
I'm not challenging you. I heard George Wald speak in 1971 in Cambridge, and there was a little bit of heckling in Harvard Square about how to get out of the war, and George Wald said, you want to know how to get out of the war? Just get in your boats, and we leave the war. And I always thought that sounded right. What I'm trying to bring up again is, why not? Even if it is unrealistic or impractical, why not just total instant disarmament?
On whose part? Do you think that the Russians are ready for this?
No, I would say, who are we to say what the Russians are ready for?
Mm-hmm.
What is your opinion about are taking that position? Who are we to say what anyone does? Let us take a very naive view and do what we think is useful. Mm-hmm. Let us. Why couldn't we assume a non-projective role? Just project peace.
Uh-huh.
What do you? I mean.
Well, this sort of comes under the head of, you know, what would you do if you were president? I'm not the president. I'm not in a position to make that decision, and I'm quite sure that anyone who is would not make a decision to junk our entire defense system.
I just wondered what you meant by unrealistic.
Just that, what I've just said, that it's not likely to happen.
Right.
I don't say that it isn't desirable. I said it's just not likely to happen. Well, that's all. Anybody else have any ideas on this subject?
It seems to me that you just said only the president could make the decision. Is the purpose of your talk to in some way influence the decision?
I don't understand your question.
If only the president can make the decision, but is the purpose of your talk in any way to influence the decision? Or is it just to explain the possibilities? I'm not sure what the purpose is.
No, excuse me. I was making a few observations that some of you may not know, to the effect that the man who knew more about the atom bomb than anybody else, 20 years later, still considered that it would eventually result in destroying the planet.
I think that's the most valuable thing you've said so far.
Yeah. Well, we don't have to keep talking about the atom bomb. We can talk about anything else. But if anyone else has anything further to say, yes.
Could I ask you to what extent you think perhaps Armageddon is destined? Do you believe in this? Do you believe in such things?
I wouldn't venture an opinion. I just don't know.
It does seem, though, that the people in charge believe this particular myth, and they're willing to go with it.
Willing to go with what? You mean that?
Yes.
What are they willing to go with?
Well, they've built the doomsday machines now, and the bombs and so on.
Mm.
So apparently that's the way they tend. So we have a bad myth on our hands there, apparently.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
For me, this talk would go much better if we only talked about evidence and not about hypotheses. Thank you.
What evidence? What evidence are you talking about?
You've given two pieces of evidence. You have given two pieces of evidence. I don't know of any more myself.
Oh.
I'm not an expert in this field.
Yeah. Well, suppose we talk about something else. I'm sure that this subject has been pretty well worked over. Yes, someone has a question there, I believe.
Yeah, what is your opinion of the ERA and the women's movement in general?
Of the what?
The ERA. I read in an interview with you in Rolling Stone College Papers, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said you thought women were a biological mistake.
Well, that mistake would imply someone who made the mistake. So perhaps it's a metaphysical, a very metaphysical question, that. It implies someone that made the mistake. What I am actually saying is that the contradictions that arise in a dualistic universe, which is postulated on either our propositions, male or female, this or that, are ultimately insoluble. Yes.
Would you talk a little about writing Port of Saints, how it was put together?
Yes. Whenever I write a book, I usually use about one third of the material. I have a lot left over, and so this was partly an overflow from Wild Boys and The Exterminator, and was assembled, as most of my books are assembled, sort of on an associational logic. Those things are put together that are associated. More or less, I'm trying to approximate what happens in a dream, the sort of synthesis of material. And that was the general plan of assembling of the material. Well, let's have some other subject here.
To switch from atom bombs to something farther off, what about extraterrestrial intelligence, communication with other planets? Is it possible? Are we going to communicate with them, or are they already communicating with us?
Well, if there's any validity in the flying saucer sightings, et cetera, I've never seen one myself, but I know people that have, would indicate that their technology is far in ahead of, far in advance of ours, so that they would be presumably communicating with us. There may be, I mean, people have speculated that we have reached a point now where we are a danger to ourselves and perhaps to others in the cosmos.
Well, would there be a possibility of communicating with them telepathically, or perhaps, you know, vice versa?
Well, I think that all communication between between people now is at least partially telepathic, and I remember the Navy has a program of communication. So that they'll know how to communicate with alien beings if they ever contact them. I think Dr. Lilly was in on that at one time. This is all part of the Dolphin Project. Interspecies communication, that's the word. Well, it seems to me that all communication is interspecies communication. That is, communicating with another person is very approximate. So I think that the whole problem of communication is of such difficulty that it's about as easy, it'd be about as easy to communicate with aliens as it is with anyone.
Mr. Burroughs, the U.S. government gave up investigating UFOs in 1969.
Huh?
The U.S. government, factually speaking, gave up investigating UFOs in 1969, more than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they said anyway. I don't believe anything they say about anything, really.
Why don't you ask them for their budget so you can check it out? Mm.
They're asked repeatedly for their budget, but of course, a great deal of the budgets, particularly of something like the CIA, are concealed.
You've made numerous comments based on hypotheses, and I hear very little evidence.
Well, what evidence do you have to present? Evidence of what?
For the questions, I have no evidence. Mm-hmm. Just like you, I've never seen a UFO.
Yeah, I've never seen one. But I think there's enough sightings to say that there probably is something to it.
Mr. Burroughs.
Yes.
Stand up. I heard you announce your new book, Cities of the Red Night. Is that right? I get it backwards sometimes. And I wondered for an author of prominence like yourself, how you found the publishing market now in terms of being receptive to your own fiction and also just in terms of other people's work.
From what point of view? Do you mean from the point of view of, say, an unpublished author? Getting published, I mean...
Well, that's my own curiosity.
You mean from the point of view of the royalties and...
No, I'm just wondering, do you find that your own publishers are looking for different stuff, different material from you? Or, you know, are they making demands? Are you under demand in the sense of contracts and things to provide? Or are you actually at liberty to write and market your works as you will?
I am completely at liberty. That is, they don't make any changes or ask for any changes. But I think that's true of most writers. The old days of editors who really edited, like Perkins, I think are pretty much a thing of the past. The publisher either accepts the work or they don't.
Along that line, is there anything being written today that publishers, what kind of thing is being written today that publishers don't accept?
I don't know of anything, any classification. I think it's just a question of whether they think the book will sell or not. And then, of course, there's a certain amount of prestige publishing books that they know won't sell, but which will give them a certain amount of prestige.
There's nothing left like in the days of Naked Lunch when... They won't take it?
I don't think so. I don't think there are any taboo subjects left. That is certainly one of the things that has been accomplished in the past 20 years in the Cultural Revolution is the abolition of censorship.
I'd like to address a question to you about dreams. Do you have conscious awareness in your dreams? Whenever you are having a dream, do you also have conscious awareness inside that dream? And also, how would you characterize dream logic?
Well, sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Very often I know that it is a dream. Is that what you mean by conscious awareness, knowing that it's a dream?
Say, in your dream, can you say you want to go to a destination and go there consciously? Find something, seek something in a dream consciously and find it?
The answer is sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. And I've done a lot of experiments along this line because I write all my dreams down. I'm a light sleeper, so I wake up 6 or 7 times in the course of the average night and write dreams down. And I found that sometimes I'm able to control a dream, and sometimes I'm able to direct myself before going to sleep to dream about a certain subject, and sometimes not.
Could you give an example of a dream where you've had conscious control?
Well, following Don Juan, you see, Don Juan said that the important thing was to see your hands in a dream. And I made an effort to do this a number of times. And only a couple of times did I succeed in actually seeing my hands in a dream.
I practiced for 3 months at one time and found my hands in 3 successive dreams.
Well, the dream in which I saw my hands, I looked in the mirror and my face was black. I turned into a Negro, but I looked down, my hands were still white. So I had made a conscious attempt to see my hands. That was one of the few times that I succeeded. Dream logic seems to proceed on associations. That is, one thing is associated with another. For example, a Paris restaurant could lead you to Paris, France, according to dream logic, which is also literal use of words. And I suppose you all know, to me, one of the most important new facts about dreams is that they are a biologic necessity. See, they have made experiments of waking people up whenever they start to dream. They can tell by the rapid eye movements and also by the brain waves. The brain waves of dreams are very much like the brain waves of people when they're awake. And if they keep interfering with the REM sleep, that is the dream sleep, very soon the subject will show all the symptoms of sleeplessness, no matter how much a dreamless sleep they are allowed. And eventually it would be fatal. It's within 2 weeks or so. So we know now that dreams are a biologic necessity, which means that they must serve a very important function.
What do you think of the decline of literacy that's been happening?
The what?
Decline of literacy.
Nothing. I don't understand the word.
Decline of literacy.
Oh, the decline of literacy. You mean that fewer people can read?
Right.
Well, oh. I don't know. Do you think this was a fact? I thought everyone was required to know how to read, that they were forced to learn how to read. Are you meaning something a little more than literacy?
Well, people go to school, but you know, not many people actually, once they're out of school, continue reading. You know, they watch TV and stuff.
That's very true, but still, the book market has never been better than it is now. There's enough people buying books. And I think there are more people buying books, I mean, per capita now, say, than there were 40, 50 years ago.
Uh-huh, but there are a lot more people now.
Yeah, well, no, I meant taking that into account.
Oh.
I meant by per capita, I mean taking all that into account.
What you said earlier about dream logic and it following association lines, and then you said following the lines of the literal meanings of words, or the literalness of words, then I kind of believe dreams to be very much images. How do words and images relate here? Do we see images and perceive them as words, or even in dreams?
Well, you have both words and images, of course, in most dreams. It's comparable to a film. And sometimes, of course, you'll have more preponderance of words, and sometimes a preponderance of images. I made quite a collection, say, of dream phrases Those words that occurred in dreams are often just words between sleeping and waking. And you get a very peculiar sort of grammar. If I can remember, where naked troubadours shoot snotty baboons was one. And, It came in as words. I'm talking about now is coming in as words without any real, any clear image content. But I think more often you have the words and image mixed just as they are in a talking film.
Mr. Burroughs, you mentioned the danger that we present now to ourselves and maybe to the larger cosmos. Have any good ideas for escaping from that danger?
No.
No?
Frankly, no.
Really?
I don't.
Boy, in your book sometimes it seems like there's
well,
naturally,
Leary says, and I think I certainly agree with him, that the next step is to go into space, to leave the planet. But we're not there yet.
Well, you think there's any possibilities of leaving the planet maybe in some unbodily kind of way?
Yes. Yes, I have a note on this here. Here we have an artifact weighing about 170 pounds that cannot exist outside of a very specialized environment, sort of a whole aqualung. And the official space programs, how do they propose to solve this? Well, they're going to move this whole artifact, the human artifact, in its environment from one place to another. It wouldn't occur to them to start from the other end. Now, you have an object, X, that's the human body, and you want to transport X, say, from Earth to space, from E to S. And X is heavy, and it can only live in a whole medium. So why not so alter X as to reduce its weight and its dependency on its medium? That would seem to be a logical approach to the problem. And this would not occur to the official programs because they accept the human artifact with all its limitations. In effect, they accepted limitations imposed by Christianity, by what Crowley calls the slave gods. Now, the human body is much too dense for space conditions. We have a model to hand, and that is less dense. In fact, almost weightless, and that would be the astral or dream body. And I postulate that the function of dreams may be to prepare us for space. And that is why they are a biologic necessity.
Well, you think there could be some kind of attitude of detachment from the body that could help
be what?
That? Some detachment from do you think that there could be some kind of attitude of detachment from this bodily nature that might help us along that way?
Well, I was just suggesting that research should be directed in towards making the human artifact more transportable instead of spending all these vast sums on transporting it in its present condition. Now, as to whether you could get a dream body to exist apart from the physical body, well, that would be a matter for research. I don't think very much being done on that, along those lines, officially at any rate.
Do you still practice the discipline of doing easy that you described in your book, The Job?
Pardon?
Do you still practice the discipline of doing easy that you described in the book called The Job that you wrote?
As best I can, yes.
It still works.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so obvious that it's the easy way to do things, but it's also extremely difficult to do. But vipassana, Alan? The awareness of what you're doing at all times?
Mindfulness,
yes. It really is a very old discipline, and seemingly very easy, but in point of fact, very difficult indeed. But I find that, for example, if you drop something or spill something, there's always a reason for it. If you can remember what you were thinking at that moment, you'll usually find that you were thinking about some person in an antagonistic way. It's as if someone suddenly joggled your arm. That shouldn't happen if you're completely mindful. You should never drop anything or make an error. But we do, I do, certainly.
Could the dream body be an aspect of the water body, the water element, which we already contain? Whether it's developed or not is another issue, but could the dream body be an aspect of the water element?
It could, certainly. I was saying we don't know very much about it. I think the man that's done the most research on this subject is Robert Monroe, who wrote Journeys Out of the Body, and I was down to see him. He's got a lot of machinery there. That he thinks that he can eventually exteriorize people by a machine. And I don't know how effective these machines are. I saw some of them, but I didn't see them in operation. But I know he's gone a long way since then. That was about 3 years ago.
What I'm getting at is we have four bodies, the astral, or the air, the mental, the earth, and the water, that Robert Monroe also, I mean, is very advanced. He is the closest. He is the closest source of information to this unknown.
I think so, yes. He's worked very closely with Kubler-Ross, the dying woman, the one that comes to see people when they're dying. You know, when you see Kubler-Ross, you know you've really had it.
Thank you.
Monroe has also had some association with Jane Roberts. Have you ever made such?
No, I don't know the name. In what way?
Well, he just visited to study her mediumship with this entity, Seth, which you probably have heard of, maybe.
No, I didn't know that. But
next time you see him, maybe you could ask him.
But he has done all this under test conditions, I know, and has actually, you know, gone places and then come back and described them accurately and all this sort of thing. I don't think he's a fraud. No, I don't. Although I can't say that I've ever, by following his instructions, gotten the same results. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on your idea that words can cause cancer.
Can cause what?
Cancer.
Cancer?
Yeah. You said it in the job.
Well, I think that they're probably part, that can be part of the whole cancer process. There's no doubt but what there's a very strong psychosomatic element in cancer, and it may well be associated with any neurosis is inner conflict is apt to be more verbal than anything else. I mean, there's obsessive verbalization. So in that sense, yes.
Okay, thanks.
I've heard Alan say a couple times that he foresees the destruction of the world and that we've gone too far. And I have a lot of the same views, that we've pretty much done too much to turn back now. And I wanted to know how you feel about natural limits that people's instincts right before things become too hot, they'll cool down, and that our governments, before we destroy the world, that will listen to our natural instincts of survival. And how do you feel about the fact that we've grown away too far from our instincts and we're not able to recognize our natural limits anymore?
Well, you see, you're using the word we there as though there were any sort of coherence. Remember that these decisions, like the decision to drop the atom bomb on Hiroshima, was made by very, very few people. In fact, of course, we didn't, most of us didn't even know they had one until they dropped it. And you see, those people are in such a strange and really artificial position that that anything sort of like self-regulating limits would not apply to them. And it's also possible that some individuals may think that they have a way of escaping. They don't intend to be here when it goes up, in other words. That's something that, a possibility.
What I meant by we was just the human race, and that generally that the masses of people who were more in touch with their...
But they've got nothing to say about it. They've got nothing to say about anything. Look at the atom bomb people. How many people were involved in that decision? Just a handful. They weren't the human race. There were a few officials and military people. We didn't, the masses, the so-called voting public, knew nothing about the bomb. In fact, even in New Mexico, where they were making it, people outside the reservation didn't know what they were doing.
So do you foresee...
Pardon?
Do you foresee destruction? I mean, do you...
I don't foresee anything. I'm not setting myself up as a prophet here.
Okay.
I just don't know. But certainly the destructive potential is there. And the fact is that anybody can make an atom bomb now. Any physics major can make one. Not a very effective one, but, you know, it would take out Boulder, for example. Didn't take much of a bomb, but...
I was reading in your Paris Review, you talked about a Dr. Dent and how he helped you get over your drug habit. I'd like to know what he, you know, influenced you with.
Dr. Dent is dead many years ago, and the apomorphine treatment which he gave is not being used in many places. They're using it still a little bit in England and in Denmark. And I think they're using it also in Switzerland for both alcoholism and drug addiction. But it's never had any use in America. I mean, it's been pretty much rejected by the medical establishment here.
Mr. Burroughs, I'd like to ask you your feelings about the function of the artist in a society in which politics is so important in terms of the life and death of the human race. Mm-hmm. Specifically, if we can make a metaphor between a heroin junkie in the United States as a profit junkie and a comfort junkie, isn't the function of the artist like Dr. Dent?
I don't quite see the relation of the artist to Dr. Dent. Well, to me, the function of art and the function, in fact, of all creative thought is to make people aware of what they know and don't know that they know. You can't tell anybody anything they don't know already on some level. For example, in the Middle Ages, the people on the seacoast, they knew the earth was round. They believed it was flat because the church said so. And similarly, and of course this becomes part of common knowledge. In other words, the effect of an artist or of a creative thinker is indirect compared with politics. It's not immediate. Although it can be, for good or for bad, it didn't take long for the theoretical formula of matter into energy to be translated into an atom bomb. And certainly, writers, artists are very influential in influencing thought and fashions and so on. A great deal of the changes that have taken place in the past 40 years, the Cultural Revolution, have been at least partly due to the work of artists and writers, filmmakers, creative work in the widest sense.
Mr. Burroughs, do you feel that the use of mind-altering drugs increases your creativity or stifles it?
I wouldn't put it as an either-or proposition. It depending on the person, it might increase it to some extent, and certainly he would. You see, using such drastic drugs as mescaline and LSD is certainly an important experience. And I think that writers have profited from that experience. I don't see that any, should we say, moderate use of such drugs or occasional use of such drugs would do anything to stifle someone's ability.
Would you comment on the fact that the big science boys named the Banisteriopsis copy element isolated as telepathine? Would you comment on this?
Yes, I think it was just the rumor. You see, the medicine men used it presumably to potentiate their psychic powers, and that the discoverers, the people that isolated the substance, just were guided by that to call it telepathine. But this is true to some extent, I think, of any powerful psychogenic agent, that there is, if not the actuality, at least the illusion of telepathic contact.
Do you know of any drugs along the line of LSD or mind-altering drugs that have been discovered recently that say we would not know about as common knowledge?
Yahe itself has never been, so far as I know, isolated and brought into this country in any quantity. But there have been a lot of rumors. I mean, it's 15 years ago, I heard of a drug that was so powerful that it was not released even for experimental purposes and was only going to be given to the military. That they were afraid. I talked to a doctor at that time. I was much more apt to, to take anything that anyone gave me, but I would think twice now. But he said that he couldn't take the responsibility of administering it to anyone because of the possibility of residual neural damage. Now, what this drug was, I don't know. But you see, as soon as you have a drug, it is immediately possible for a chemist to make drugs with the same potentials, but a great deal stronger. For example, quinine, you see, in World War II, as soon as they synthesized quinine, they had anti-malarial drugs that were 30 times as strong as quinine. Now, the same would potentially then be true of hallucinogenic drugs, if they could make a drug that was 20 times as strong as LSD. And they could probably make a drug that's 20 times more habit-forming than heroin if they wanted to. It's not much of a trick for a chemist.
In terms of drugs in general, could you say a little bit about how you see the concept of addiction now in terms of either a physiological cellular thing or a psychological phenomena?
There's no doubt but what addiction to opiates is physiological. All animals have been addicted, with the exception of cats who are allergic to morphine and they just go crazy, and they can't be addicted if they would die first. But all other animals can be addicted and have been addicted. So there's no question of it being anything, well, of course, anything that's physiological is also psychological. But by and large, it's a physiological process which we pretty well understand now. That the body produces a natural regulator and painkiller called endorphin. And if someone uses opiates, then the body stops manufacturing endorphin. When the opiate is withdrawn without the natural painkiller, any little thing can become agonizing until the body goes back starts producing endorphin again. That is apparently the explanation for withdrawal symptoms. It's simply that there's no endorphin being produced in the body.
I was going to ask a question about reincarnation. I've read a book, I think it was Lyle Watson or Colin Wilson, I never can remember, about a sect called the Cathars in the Middle Ages that were reputedly reincarnating. Have you heard anything about that or any comment on
that? Not about that particular sect, no. But, well, I personally subscribe to the theory of reincarnation, but I would say any closely knit group, should we say, where you get in Europe where people have lived in the same area for 1,000 years as they have in parts of Switzerland, for example, that we must assume that the same people are coming back again and again and again to practice the same professions. Yes.
I just want to, I think it's a correction. I think you meant endorphins, not endocrines. I think they're different things.
My pronunciation may be wrong. It's endorphine. How do you pronounce
endorphins
it?
Endorphins as opposed to endocrines. Endocrines are a very specific, different thing.
I thought it was the, I meant, the, of course, there's a number of these compounds. There's more than one.
Well, it's good to understand that. I just didn't, but, people might go out reading about endocrines and they wanted to read about endorphins. One piece of evidence that you gave I was interested in, but I missed it. What keeps people alive? What kind of dreaming? Or what do they die from if they don't have it?
What?
You said people, it might be fatal if you didn't dream or something?
It is.
Okay. And what? How do they, on what basis do they assume that? Or do you assume
They have taken first animals, and whenever the animal starts to dream, which they can tell by rapid eye movements, they wake the animal up. So the animal gets no dream sleep. The animal is prevented from dreaming. If they go on doing this for a certain length of time, the animal shows all the symptoms of sleeplessness, restlessness, etc. And if this were carried further enough, far enough, the animal would die. In other words, dreams are a biologic necessity for any warm-blooded animal.
Would you suppose that carries over into daydreams too?
Pardon?
Does that apply to daydreams as well?
No, I don't. Of course, probably the dream process probably goes on all the time, to some extent. Yes, it would apply to dreaming in the widest sense.
What would that suggest for the Buddhist practice of waking up?
I don't know as it would suggest anything specific. Yes. We can go on for a while.
Mr. Burroughs.
Yes.
A man named Edmundo Garcia has just formed a church called the Universal Church of Hydraulics. He claims that water is the cosmic octave, and that a theology of ecology is in the works, the water works, as he says. What are your feelings regarding the old notion of the age of Aquarius? Does it mean we get vaporized, or any feelings?
I don't know. I don't have any such general ideas. He's worried about the water table, is he? Well, apparently that is something that would get short very quickly is the water supply. He probably has good reason to be concerned.
What do you think of the possibilities of multiple universes and at the possibility that dreams are communications with our own possible selves and other possible universes?
I would be inclined to subscribe to that. There was a man named John Donne, not the poet John Donne. He was an English mathematician and physicist, and he wrote a book called An Experiment with Time, which was published in 1924. And he found that his dreams contained future material from the future. And he said that anybody that will write their dreams down over a period of time will turn up incidents in the dreams that clearly refer to future occurrences. And I've done this over a period of time and have turned up a number of these. But he also developed a theory called the serial universe, which is here you are, and then there's an observer above that, an observer above that, to infinity. So he definitely did think that dreams were contact with different levels of the serial universe.
Do you think it's also a possibility that when you're dreaming, you're not actually predicting the future, but when that comes, that you actually made that happen, drawing it from the dream?
I wouldn't go so far as that, but Donne makes a very important point. He said, if you dream, say, about an earthquake or a fire, and this is happens, I've had this happen, you are not dreaming about the event itself, but about the moment when you become aware of it, usually a newspaper picture or something like that. In other words, you are dreaming of your future time track. And there's not much to suggest that you have any influence, at least not in that kind of dream. There's someone right there.
Do you have an opinion on whether there's actually a group of people in control of the nation or the world that are using a rigorous, systematic kind of control, such as in Mayan society?
Well, yes, I think I've spoken about the atom bomb and the very few people that were concerned in that decision. And I think that is true of, to a large extent, of a number of decisions. I think that, for example, Western countries are, in point of fact, controlled by very few people. As to any one group, controlling the whole world, no, I don't think any one group is that powerful. But certainly, international cartels do control prices, interest rates, all sorts of economic factors, by agreement of a very few people. Price of gold, for example.
And is that enough to control people's behavior, or to?
Well, if you can control the economics of a country, you're going very far towards controlling the behavior. If you're controlling it in a general way, you don't need to have any more control than that. I mean, there's no need for anyone to have control over every individual.
Okay, thank you.
going back to dreams, there's a poet, his name I think is Brian Geisen, who created a machine called the Dream Machine. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I was there when it was created. It is a stroboscope, in effect. It's flicker. And Gray Walters, who was one of the early experimenters with flicker, found that it produced many of the effects of hallucinogenic drugs, that is, breaking down the compartments of the senses, that is, seeing sounds and hearing odors and all that sort of thing that occurs with hallucinogenic drugs, could be produced by flicker, which is pulses of light into the eye at a certain frequency, at the alpha frequency, I think between 8 and 15 per second. And this is a device for doing that. It has a light in a revolving cylinder with slots so that it can be set for a certain frequency.
Now, what actually happens?
It has some of the effects, as I said, of hallucinogenic drugs, and you see all sorts of patterns, and sometimes visions like cities, things like that.
I heard that there's a dream machine in the basement of the Museum of Modern Art. Is that being used?
I think they have one, and there's one also in the Beaubourg Museum in Paris. And I think that Brian is going to install another one there at the Beaubourg in Paris.
In a dream once, I was able to do algebra in the dream, and I remembered what I'd done in the dream, and I had never been able to do it before, and when I woke up, I was able to do these equations. And I don't know how to explain that.
Well, there's a famous story about a man who solved an equation in a dream, I believe. He saw the equation had been bothering him, then all of a sudden it joined in a certain way. And so I think that this is an experience that happens quite often. The idea that dreams are completely illogical, of course, is not true at all. I have gotten from dreams perfectly coherent narrative stories. No one would know it was a dream. Sometimes I get a whole chapter that way, which I've in fact read. I pick up a book in a dream and read it. And then I'm able sometimes to transcribe that later when I'm awake.
Back to art and politics, just as nobody's really paying attention to the anti-nuclear movement except people who are already anti-nuclear, I was wondering who you consider your audience to be, and is anybody really affected by art but artists?
I think they are profoundly affected by artists, but perhaps not directly or immediately. By artists and by creative ideas. My heavens, look at what came of Karl Marx.
How many people have read Karl Marx?
It isn't necessary that so many people have read them. Look at the number of people who are affected by it. And I think that the example, as I was pointing out, the whole cultural revolution which has taken place in the past 40 years is certainly to a large extent due to artists and creative people, that is, filmmakers, so on.
Could you talk a little bit about your interest in the Johnson family?
About what?
Your interest in the Johnson family?
Well, yes, I was... I am writing a book on the Johnson family, called The Johnson Family. I read you the... It was a turn-of-the-century expression to designate sort of good bums and thieves, and it was elaborated then into a code of conduct, about a Johnson, what a Johnson does and does not do. A Johnson honors his obligations, his word is good, and is a good man to do business with. A Johnson minds his own business. He is not a snoopy, tail-bearing, interfering, self-righteous type of person. And a Johnson will help when help is needed. He will not stand by while someone is drowning or trapped under a burning car. I had a friend who was had an accident. He hit a cow going 90 miles an hour and was trapped under his car. And some salesmen came along. They wouldn't even get out of their car. And some truck driver came along and got him out. But so, and the show business designation for a Johnson is he's good people. So, it also occurred to me that in the planning this book, that the Johnsons are also would be ideal people to have in space with you. And I postulated that, for example, postulate that there's no privacy and no deceit possible in space, that your innermost thoughts and feelings and intentions are immediately apparent to those around you, so you want to be very careful who is around you.
You've already said something about the connection between dreams and your writing. Mm-hmm. Some people have thought there was an important connection between watching a movie and having a dream. Suzanne Langer, I think, for example. And I was wondering if you could comment on the relation between movies and your writing on the one hand and movies and dreams on the other.
Well, because a dream is, in point of fact, a film. And also, people, I myself, and I suppose everybody, frequently dreams about films that they've seen. There's certainly a feedback, immediate feedback there. Well, that's about all.
I'm coming back to the nuclear because I've been sitting here and listening to the younger generation concerned about nuclear, and they have been the only group that had any impact at all on the protesting of the nuclear. Whereas if the young people will work upon the older people who are plugged in to what they call the bottom line to make money, and also because they fear that they're going to be without any energy. Now, if the young people will start to working on the older people, I think we can make a big impact. That's my comment.
Well, well, one hopes so, yes. But I think a lot of the pro-nuclear people are so set in that opinion they're not going to change. Because they just don't want to hear anything about the facts. They completely close their mind to the dangers of low-level radiation, any of those things. I mean, naturally, they never heard of Oppenheimer, let alone of what Oppenheimer thought about the atom bomb and its potentials. And they're really just set in ignorance. I don't know how successful anyone would be in changing their mind. They're pretty stupid anyway.
Getting back to movies and dreams and what you said about the flicker machine, I was wondering what kind of influence the television has in altering your mind and how you think about that.
Well, I don't, I hardly look at television, so I don't know, I don't have much of an opinion.
Yeah, but how about the millions of people that do?
I know, yeah. Well, it's a continual input that must be having a very profound effect on their mind, quite apart from even the content. Just the fact that they're sitting there and watching this thing for hours on end.
Yeah. Is there some kind of theory that the flicker of the television set creates a kind of hypnosis that can be very influential?
Yeah, I've heard of that, and I've heard also that something about microwaves, actual damage from certain type, certain television reception.
Do you think you could feed back on this? In other words, do you think the TV is giving off vibrations? Do you think that the human being could actually feed back down the line?
You mean that he could affect television?
Well, I guess, well, in the terms of what I'm saying, well, you know, music feedback.
Yes, it's quite possible. You see, they've done research of attaching, actually, the mind to a computer so that there was a feedback between the mind and the computer, and the mind was giving electrical signals to the computer. So, yes, you could actually at least change the stations by thinking about it. That's potentially quite possible. There's a lot about that in the Secret Life of Plants. How many of you have read that book? It's quite, you know. Remember the man that had a circuit set up so that he could turn on his television by thinking about it, even from another city. Yes, it certainly is possible.
You've experimented with a Reichian orgone accumulator. Mm-hmm. Did you have any results?
Well, yes, I think there's no doubt but what something is happening. I've had people go into, you know, not knowing nothing about Reich and not being told what to expect, and they all reported that something was happening in there, that there's a prickling of the skin, and they thought that it was attached up to some kind of an electrical system. And I do think that it is very important for cancer, I mean, for the possibility of cancer cure, and it's been completely neglected by the medical establishment. But a doctor with a space program named Cohn came out with his electrical cell theory of cancer, which is identical with Reich's theory, although he gave no acknowledgement to Reich.
Mr. Burroughs, because you're such an acclaimed writer, do you consider writers as not spiritual but social prophets? And do you, and could you cite examples through your work if you feel so?
I didn't quite get the question. I think
do you feel that writers are social prophets? And if you feel that way, could you cite an example with your works? Thank you.
I don't think that writer is necessarily a social prophet. There may well be events in his book that later happened in fact, and of course, a writer certainly have an influence on events. That is, people modeled themselves on writers, like a whole generation modeled themselves on Fitzgerald's writing. That's not exactly prophecy. It's influence rather than prophecy.
Mr. Burroughs, would you please comment on the possibility that since the atomic bomb, the credibility in the scientific community has been destroyed to the extent that the opinions of that community are pretty much worthless in undoing the damage which has been done?
Well, undoubtedly, they have lost a degree of credibility by getting something started which they are apparently unable to control, and they can't have come up with no solution to the problem of atomic waste. So that is certainly enough to destroy anyone's credibility, to have created a problem of such magnitude without a solution to it.
I have a twofold question, which is first, about a year ago, I was stopped. I was in a movie, and I started talking to someone, and he explained to me, he was a filmmaker, and he was involved in mind movies, and Do you know anything about mind movies?
No, I don't know what he means. Did he explain to you what he meant by a mind movie?
He was working on this process with other filmmakers and engineers, and where they take through a magnetic tape, they pass it through a computer, the signal alpha and beta signals, and then you experience the movie in your mind as opposed to on a screen.
Well, I think that this is something towards which movie makers are striving, but I don't think I don't know if they've accomplished it yet.
Yeah. The second question is, you mentioned orgone energy, mm-hmm. and there's a theory that UFOs are somehow propelled by that.
No, I didn't suggest that UFOs were propelled.
Do you know anything about that?
No.
Okay.
I understand there are people called arhats who are in deep states of meditation in caves in various parts of the world who are seeking to change the destructive direction. And I was wondering if you have any comments on that, and also what I'm getting at is what power people who meditate might exert on these questions, destructive questions.
Well, theoretically, they could assert almost unlimited power. That is, there's no doubt about it, but what human beings use just a tiny fraction of their actual potentials. That is, we have potentially photographic memory for everything that's happened to us. We know such a tremendous amount that we know and don't know that we know. And so potentially, someone could very directly influence the minds of politicians and military men. As to whether they are actually able to do this at this time, I just don't know. Where are these people supposedly located? Is there any suggestions?
In the Himalayan mountains. This was told to me by a Sufi master. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's possible, and we certainly hope so. Certainly hope that someone knows what they're doing.
What developments do you think we'll see happen in poetic and literary form in the next 20 years and into the 21st century?
That's a very, very difficult to say. For example, painting. Where painting is now, I just don't know. They've gotten away almost from the to a point where they don't have anything to sell. They've lost the article. Now, I know a painter named Les Levine. He puts on a show, and I said, "Well, Les, what are you selling? Where is the thing that people can buy?" And it isn't there. It's a happening. It's as if the writer had somehow gotten rid of the book. The painter has gotten rid of the canvas. What they are selling then is a happening, or an event like this guy that did the wall or the what was it? Yeah. So where they can go from here, how they can go further, I don't know. And writing seems to be have reached a sort of a limit. There's a limit, really a definite limit to experimental writing if you want people to read it. For example, you could not do in writing what is called minimal expressionism, where you have, say, a canvas with slightly different shades of the same color on it. It would be intolerable in writing to have the same thing said with very slight variations. So I don't know, as writing is going very much further, going to be very much different, say, in the next 20 years than it is now. There's one invention that might have, if they ever really perfected a throat mic that was sensitive enough to pick up subvocal speech, then you would have something almost as revolutionary as the camera was for artists, because you wouldn't have to guess at when you were transcribing someone's stream of consciousness. You could actually record it. But to date, there is no microphone that's sensitive enough to pick this up. We know that subvocal speech makes sound. but we can't pick it up yet.
So do you think we're like dependent then on some sort of technological development or discovery in order to move writing ahead, move writing further, move it out there?
Well, you'd have to specify just what we're moving. Undoubtedly, this, as I said, this to record subvocal speech would require equipment we don't have yet. But there's no reason why we shouldn't have it. I mean, it's certainly within the realm of possibilities.
I'd like to ask you a question about your own personal literary habits at the time. Would you could you go into what your current reading is right now and any recommended reading you might have to suggest?
Well, actually, I've got a reading list. I gave last summer a course that I called Creative Reading, and I have a list, a reading list, which I'm continually adding to. I mean, if you wanted to see me after class and get a copy, have a copy made. I read a great deal. I read a great deal of just sort of bestsellers. And a book that I recommend that I just read is Shibumi. It's violently anti-American, and it's a bestseller, which is interesting in itself. There's another very good one called The Contaminant, about how Russia and America are inducing cancer, that is, you know, putting cancer-producing agents into the food. And first the Americans do it, and then they find out the Russians are doing it as well. It's all too probable, actually. The same is true about this book, Shibumi. The story is that the America is really run by something called the Mother Company, which is above the CIA, and nobody knows about it. And they are fixing petroleum prices. It's essentially a cartel of petroleum and energy. Sounds all too likely. It's all done by their whole power depends on a computer called Fat Boy. What? Very interesting book. I recommend it. Anyone read it? Nobody's read Shibumi? It's Japanese training or word. It's all over. I mean, it's a big bestseller. You can't miss it. And it's well worth reading. So.
The manager of Lawrence Cavell's is reading Shibumi and enjoying it. The manager of Lawrence Cavell's is reading Shibumi. What role does music play in your life?
Music?
And has there ever been a serious art music composer that you've been affected by or liked?
No, I really don't know. I'm not at all knowledgeable about music. I like Moroccan music and Indian music. I'm not much into rock and roll. And I just don't know much about music, frankly.
Could you comment on what inspired you to use the cut-up method? And if so, do you still use this as a method of writing composition?
It was not my invention or my idea at all. It was Brian Geisen, who said that writing is 50 years behind painting. And he simply applied the montage method, which had at that time, this was in 1959, been used for 50 years in painting. It was pretty old hat in painting, actually, at that point. Well, now, this applies to what I said about making people aware of what they know and don't know that they know. Because he simply made explicit with scissors what happens all the time in the human nervous system, that as you walk around the block and come back and put down what you've seen either on paper or on canvas, you've seen a melange of fragments. It isn't you haven't seen anything sequential narrative or picture. And whenever you walk down the street, your consciousness is cut by random factors, or when you look out the window. This is a process that's going on all the time, and the cut-up method simply made this explicit.
Bill, in following on that question about the origin of cut-up and function, and your statement before that there is a limit to experimental art if you want to have anybody read your book or look at your work. What is your opinion, or how do you what's your attitude toward a soft machine, Ticket That Exploded, and Nova Express as, quote, far out experimental works in Finnegan's Wake, say? And what lessons have you learned from that kind of experiment, and what generalizations have you derived from the experience?
Yes. Well, I feel that in those three books, I was perhaps too much taken up in the experiment itself, instead of using the material only insofar as it contributed to the work as a whole. And so I don't, I use cut-ups now just in certain situations. For example, if you're trying to portray a state of delirium, I think they're very, very useful for that. Or say if someone has driven from the airport to his hotel and he's lying down and pictures are flicking through his mind, that the cut-up method works very well there. But there is a tendency with writers, I think, to get too hung up on an experimental line of writing so that they don't get back to a coherence where they can be read. I think that we're still going to have, we still need sequential narrative if people are going to read books.
Or phases of consideration did you go through before you arrived at this conclusion? Or what stages of practice of cut-up did you go through? You know, the first work, say minutes ago, was pure cut-up and pure random without particular editing. Then there was construction of thematic novels with cut-up, with the cut-ups aggregated around the theme. But the whole novel composed of cut-up material. Then was there an intermediary stage before you went back to narrative?
No. There are all sorts of combinations possible. Lots of times I'll cut up a page, I don't get anything. Maybe I get one sentence and put it back in so you can't even tell that it's a cut-up. There's no necessity of using everything that you get. And very soon I started editing and rearranging and taking what I wanted from the cut-ups.
Did the cut-up style affect your own brain functioning or your own thinking process or your own composition process or your own stylistics?
Yes, I would say that the cut-ups give a general, because it's making explicit something that happens all the time, increases your range of awareness, and therefore, contributes to, gives you a wider range of your fictional viewpoint.
You're talking about mental awareness.
Yes.
Does it also have any effect on your actual sentence composition?
Yes, to some extent.